Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Thou shalt not steal if there is a direct victim. Thou shalt not worship pop idols or follow lost prophets. Thou shalt not take the names of Johnny Cash, Joe Strummer, Johnny Harmon, Desmond Dekker, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, or Sid Barrett in vain. Thou shalt not think any man over the age of 30 that plays with a child that is not their own is a paedophile. Some people are just nice. Thou shalt not read NME. Thou shalt not stop liking a band just because they've become popular. Thou shalt not question Stephen Fry. Thou shalt not judge a book by its cover. Thou shalt not judge Lethal Weapon by Danny Glover. Thou shalt not buy Coca-Cola.
Thou shalt not judge a book by its cover. Thou shalt not judge Lethal Weapon by Danny Glover. I don't know why, but I'm sort of like tired of starting these shows with that William Shatner, Henry Rollins thing. Although I love it, but I need something new. All right, so we have a lot of... What was it I said during the little... We call that a billboard, the thing that runs right before the news, in between... The news runs between a little something that I say and then the show starts. The thing that I say is called a billboard. And I must have said something that... I don't know what's happening. I'm very confused. But we have what we would consider to be a full board of calls right now. So I think it's kind of my job to kind of get through a bunch of them. So we're going to start with Kari from Hamden. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was fully vaccinated for COVID in March and had an appointment for a booster last week that I wasn't able to keep because I contracted COVID. Now that I'm feeling much better, I want to get the word out about how effective the monoclonal antibodies infusion was for me and how important it is if you have asthma or another condition of risk to ask your physician to refer you early on. I myself thought that I had to wait to have serious symptoms before asking for the treatment, and by that time, there were no treatment slots available for 3 days. I got lucky and someone canceled, and I didn't have to wait. And I feel quite certain the infusion kept me from being hospitalized, at which time I was told you can no longer receive the infusion. So the learning is that people at risk can ask for an appointment early, even before they have symptoms, and they can always cancel if they don't need it. I went back to my physician and told her what I thought, and she thanked me and then confessed that she had not gotten used to the idea that people who are vaccinated can still get very sick.
Yeah, no, I know a number of people. First of all, I'm happy you're better. We're all happy you're better. You sound better. I've known a number of people who've had breakthrough infections that have been significant. You know, I mean, you can get really sick. And yeah, the point that you're making, I think we could even sort of expand the window a little bit and say what we're facing right now, and we don't know yet what Omicron has in store for us, maybe just more of the same, maybe something different. But, you know, you have this sort of complex window in which the monoclonals – and maybe even more importantly, the antivirals. I mean, these new antivirals that are coming on board seem to work very effectively. But, you know, you got about 72 hours to get going on them. And you can't get them until you've obviously tested positive. So there's going to be a real burden on testing, too. You're going to need rapid testing that's highly specific and highly sensitive so highly sensitive that you get false positives. But... because, I mean, yeah, well, you've just lived through this. You know, you need to know pretty early on what you're dealing with, and they need to know that so that they can prescribe the right therapy. The monoclonals are great. It looks like these antivirals, these are going to really be something. They're really going to actually do something. But testing, super important. Got to get your test early. Never pass up an opportunity to test, as Dr. Daniel Griffin says. And it's got to be rapid, and it's got to work, right? Thanks for your call. It's all good news for you, and I'm very, very happy, but all very true, too. It's weird, too, because let me just take 2 seconds, although we get a lot of calls. But one thing that I do is every couple of days, I go over to one of the big kind of anti-vaccine, anti-masking, and now I might add anti-testing Facebook pages just to see. And basically, you know, they're doing kind of what's happening nationally in the Republican critique of the Biden administration, which is that they simultaneously complain about things that are being done to ameliorate the pandemic, and then complain also about how long the pandemic has been going. So get in the way of anything that might help and then complain about how long it's been going. That seems to be the new strategy for the Connecticut Freedom Alliance or whatever they're called. And it is kind of what's going on at the national level in the national debate, too. All right. In fact, some of the Republicans are now considering shutting the government down. In other words, obstructing a reauthorization resolution in order to force the Biden administration to withdraw vaccine mandates on private industry. So I'm going to say more about this if a little space opens up. But let's see. I'm just going to go right down the line here. I think here's Owa in Southampton, Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine.
I tried to call a couple of times. It's amazing. You don't imagine how many people are actually calling in, so I never get on.
You're on now.
Two days ago, you had a show on nothing, and then a couple of days later, you tied it a little different, but it was still about the same thing. And I'm always amazed that, because you quoted a lot of experts, Darwin, Einstein, and the fact that, like, there's questions that have never been answered, never will be answered, to me, is the answer.
I think I understand what you're saying. And I think maybe the other show, for a second, I was brought up short. I thought, really? We did two shows about nothing or nothingness or whatever. But I think the other one that you're talking about was the one where we got onto the subject of consciousness. You know, that is one of the areas where there are questions that have never been answered. I mean, the biomedical argument about consciousness, which is essentially it's all biological. To whatever extent we can't explain things, it's just because we haven't figured them out yet. That's the sort of Patricia Churchland version of that kind of an argument. And then, you have other people like David Chalmers saying, well, no, we actually need to think about this differently. I mean, if the biomedical explanation doesn't work and it doesn't seem to even come close to working, then we have to think more. You know, we have to think more broadly. So, yeah, you're right. The mysteries, they're the thing in a lot of ways. All right. What an interesting bunch of callers. By the way, the number is 888-720-WNPR, 888-720-9677. I should say that the show that we did about nothing – not the Seinfeld kind of nothing, but just the idea of nothingness. We did it a few years ago, and we re-air it periodically. But I have to be honest and say, and this is going to come up with another call, I don't really remember it very well. I would have to go back and listen to it in order to talk about it intelligently. The problem, we just do a lot of these, you know. All right, here is Sandy in Foster, Rhode Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Colin. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've heard you talk recently about how you feel like you're following politics less closely than just about any time in your life. I'm a couple of years older than you. I'm finding the same thing going on. I'm trying to figure out what's going on and why that's the case. I'm a couple of years older than you. I'm probably a little bit to the left of you. Say that I'm a Bernie Sanders, Democratic Socialist type kind of person. So I'm curious what more you have to say about that. I'm wondering whether you might do a whole show about it at some point.
I think probably the opposite will happen. First of all, thanks for your call and thanks for bringing all this up. I think that we're going to tilt a little bit more back toward. I mean, I think political burnout is understandable. And I think one of the reasons for my political burnout is that I no longer see politics, at least the most visible form of American politics, as what it used to be, which is two parties with competing ideologies who are basically playing the same game by the same rules. And then the question is, you know, in every election cycle, whether it's midterms or presidential, who do you like better? You know, whose ideas do you like better? Whose candidates do you like better? That's what I understand politics to be. I don't understand politics to be what they are right now, in which, and I'm sorry if I sound partisan, I didn't used to feel as partisan as I do now, but I feel as though the Republican Party is deeply broken. This is coming up a lot for those of us in journalism. I'll actually be back teaching sort of political journalism, theoretical and analytical political journalism in a seminar at Yale this coming spring. And you know, I mean, you have a party that no longer, in terms of its leadership and its most visible behaviors, completely subscribes to democracy. I mean, if in fact you're not going to accept election votes that you don't like, if you're going to be unwilling to verify election votes that you don't like, if you are not, if you are going to block attempts to prosecute people who staged a violent insurrection, a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, if you see that question as essentially political, whether or not to prosecute, whether or not to fully investigate, if you are going to oppose public health measures, and I'm not saying the entire Republican Party is anti-vaccine, but they ultimately have sent collectively, you know, an anti-vaccine message, a message that rejects most scientific and public health initiatives, and they've made political something that should never be political. You know, I feel a kind of exhaustion. Like, I really am quite capable of covering, you know, a political race between, you know, I don't know, I could probably cover, I can't because I have conflicts of interest. I don't want to cover Lamont versus Claritas if that's what the gubernatorial race becomes. And I think, you know, I could still cover Obama versus Romney or something like that. But this is different. This doesn't even feel like politics anymore. It just feels like this sort of weird, you know, broken playing field where one party has some kind of governing ideology that it's trying to implement and the other party has none whatsoever. It's kind of a nihilistic rejection of everything, and including the fundamental tenets of democracy. You can't have a baseball game if one team does not subscribe to any of the rules. That's the case with the Republican Party nationally right now. They want five outs, you know, and eight strikes and two balls. And, you know, I mean, you can't do that. So I think what we are going to do on this show, Sandy, here's the end of my long-winded answer. We're going to cover that. We're going to cover, like, you know, how we got so broken. But, I mean, I sort of need to come out of my hibernation a little bit. I don't know. I hope that's an answer.
Could I say one more thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because that when you talked about weariness, I identified with that. And I think for me, the biggest place of weariness is the fact that we couldn't come together around COVID, that we can't come around together about taking action that could protect all of us. That has me so flummoxed that I think that might be one of the main reasons why I'm you know, I still pay attention, but I'm a little bit lost about where to go next, what to do next.
You know, one thing that I will say about this is that, you know, counter to what's happening in the party itself, and the party itself is kind of melting down internally right now. There's tremendous feuding going on within the congressional Republican caucuses with, you know, people really kind of hating on each other in pretty graphic ways. But, you know, I think what's interesting is that mainstream political journalism has found, I think, some really, really good Republican columnists. You know, I mean, I think Ross Douthat last Sunday wrote about the fact that the Republican Party has an opportunity to reframe itself in a way that would make it much more politically viable. You know, he cites Glenn Youngkin in Virginia as an example. You know, take a little bit of Trumpism minus the nastiness and the bullying. But a little, and the conspiracy wackiness, take a little bit of Trumpism, you know, turn critical race theory into a wedge issue, and, you know, some more conventional Republican principles piled on top of that, you know, and you've got sort of a viable and winnable election strategy. And he also says he thinks the party won't do that. They'll probably blow it. And because the party seems to hunger for, as Ross says, full-on Trumpism, including full-on Trump himself. But they want a restoration. They want full-on Trumpism with all the nastiness and WWE primetime television, you know, entertainment-focused conflict, reality TV, you know, heat. That's what they want because it's like much more exciting and fun. I mean, government's not really supposed to be exciting and fun. Government's supposed to be really boring. Government's supposed to be really boring, so boring that people like me have to try to get you interested in it. But that's, you know, that's no longer the aim of the party. But what I was going to say is columnists like Douthat and Max Boot at The Washington Post and, oh, I'm blocking her name, but she's also at The Washington Post. Jennifer Rubin. And even Kathleen Parker and people like that. I mean, I think, you know, there's sort of really interesting, thoughtful Republican columnists working in mainstream media. Even Mona Charon, writing for The Bulwark, basically just went on a tear about, you know, what a terrible candidate for Senate Dr. Oz would be. Thank you, Mona. But, you know, I mean, Dr. Oz and his wackiness seems to me to be very symbolic of where a substantial amount of the Republican Party is right now. But anyway, the journalism is getting better. The commentary, I think, is getting better than it's ever been. The politicians are getting worse. All right, we're going to have to deal with this problem right now because it's making me anxious, and I'm going to have to confess to a major memory hole. But here is Nicole from Storrs. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So this is a research project. In the last week, I've heard of some kind of underground paper called the Hartford Planet. And when you Google this and librarians Google it, the only source material that comes up is an article by you from 1993.
Well, that would explain why I'm going to disappoint you. I don't remember anything about this. Like if I went back and read the article, maybe it would jog my memory a little bit. I mean, one of the problems with being really old, there's two problems. One of them is you just don't remember things anyway. I mean, you remember all kinds of things that you shouldn't remember. And the other problem for me is I've really been doing this for a long time. I've written thousands of newspaper columns, like literally many thousands of newspaper columns, and now I've done thousands of public radio shows, and before that, thousands of daily, you know, AM radio shows. And I don't remember anything about the Harvard Planet. I'm so sorry. I hope I'm not your last hope.
No, it's actually in the Library of Congress, but maybe not every issue. Of course, if you had any insight about it, I guess it was between 92 and 93, independently published from like a warehouse on Bartholomew Street. And it was sort of like underground comics plus like music stuff. I was just hoping, you know, by calling in that somebody else.
Yeah, let's.
I saved that.
Yeah, let's put it out there. 888-720-WNPR. Can anybody help Nicole here? 888-720-9677. The Hartford Planet, a publication. Also, if you just know what planet Hartford is on, you know, that might be helpful. Anything could be helpful. All right, I'm going to keep going here. These are good calls, you know. Anyway, the number 888-720-WNPR. Here's Scott in his car, or maybe not. Hi, Scott.
No. Still in the car, Colin.
Okay.
In the car. So you were talking about cognition. I love that show. Anytime you're bringing up Oliver Sacks, you're going to a great place with me.
Mm-hmm.
But quite recently, the nation of Britain has declared seafood, shellfish, crustaceans to be sentient creatures. And I think this weighs heavily on the conversation about cognition.
Yes, although
if a clam is capable, then shouldn't we be talking about it more?
Although I think it might just be lobsters, octopus, and crabs, which is also my favorite song from Oliver. Lobsters, octopus, and crabs. I think those are the ones that are sentient. I'm not sure the clams made it in this time. But, you know, yeah, I think it's really interesting anyway. I mean, look, long before my octopus teacher or whatever that thing is called, we did a show about octopuses with the science writer Cy Montgomery, who just finished a book about it. And Betsy Kaplan produced the show. And by the end of it, I could never eat octopus again. I mean, there's just no way, you know. And I love grilled octopus. I love, you know, lulas grilladas. And You know, it just like one of my favorite things, or like the Greek version of the kind of marinated grilled octopus. So good. But now it'd be like eating, you know, I don't know, a cat or something. Except that I thought octopuses might even be nicer than cats. So I don't know. One thing I would ask you about, Scott, since you're obviously a very thoughtful person, do we privilege intelligence too much? Like, you know, is it sort of like, well, this thing is smart, so I better not eat it? You know, I mean, is there – I do that, you know, but, I mean, it doesn't really make any sense, right? I mean, that's not really how we think about, I don't know, humanity.
I'm probably not the right person to ask because I've been trying to crack my way into Mensa since I was about 10. So I don't think we value it nearly enough. But it's an interesting question. It's very cognitive.
Yeah. Pigs are really, really smart. People don't hesitate to eat. I think if you're smart and kind of cute, you know, if you're an animal and you don't want to get eaten.
I think the cuteness is overly weighted.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Definitely. Because pigs are really smart. Pigs, by some measures, are smarter than dogs or cats. But people eat them because they're disgusting. I mean, like, they live disgusting lives. Babe notwithstanding. All right. Got to go over to – I don't think I've ever gotten so many calls done in the first segment of the show. Tom, you will be the last caller of this particular segment.
Yeah, no, I was distracted, but can I bring him down a little while?
Yeah, you can bring him down. Hold on. I think, Tom, I think you're doing something else. I don't really know what it was. But I thought I would be affirming and say, yeah, you could definitely bring them down. All right, I'm going to put you on hold. We're going to take a break. We needed to do that anyway. And that's all. We will be back.
I like to play baseball. I like to go swimming. We like to watch movies with pretty women. We like to eat pizza, play ping pong too. But we don't like to paint the house, scrub the floor, do you? We like to have lots of fun and sing these songs for you.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series.
And we are back. And what it is, too. So we're taking phone calls here. The number is 888-720-WNPR. That's 888-720-9677. People are calling up about all sorts of things. And I'm just going to go back to the calls here. I mean, I've got all kinds of things that I'm I'd be happy to talk about it. Oh, I do want to say one thing, which is because this just comes up when we do this. If you have questions about the show itself or what it is that we're doing or I don't know, that's another legitimate field of inquiry. I mean, I don't want to spend the whole show talking about that. But if, you know, say one or two people called in, 888-720-9677. I say that especially because we had our first real rebranding meeting yesterday and it was very interesting. Starting January 1st, we're going to be just hunting and fishing will be our main focus, and maybe some maritime law and sea shanties. But that'll be about it. This whole show will just be about that. But anyway, let's go back to the – we're going to go back to Tom. When we last left Tom, he was in Naugatuck. There was some kind of situation developing where there was some question about whether he could bring things down. And we are rejoining Tom now in progress. Hi, Tom.
I'm sorry about that, but yeah, all good in the world. I just, well, not, you know, Stephen Sondheim died, and I really loved that guy. His music was really important to me, and I've got a Stephen Sondheim story, which is, you know, can I tell my Stephen Sondheim story?
Why not?
Yeah, okay. So he was at Trinity College talking one time, and I had an old girlfriend that she knew I loved Stephen Sondheim. She bought me the ticket. I wasn't even living in Hartford at the time, but yeah, so I went there, and I decided that, you know, maybe if I look for his look, I can get a picture with it. So I go in the back, and I'm looking, going, oh, there's too many people back there. They're all going to get shacked. So I hid behind the tree. And everybody got shacked, and I like had my back, and I tell you, people were looking around, and I was just right behind the tree, and I came back, and I got an arm in arm picture with Stephen Sondheim. Nobody has that, and he signed it later for me.
Wow! So you were someone in a tree, basically.
Yeah, I was someone behind the tree.
Yeah, close enough. Close enough.
Funny that, you know, if you want something, that's the way I look at it. If you want something, like I've never done that before or since. If you want something bad enough, you do something that's outside your comfort zone.
Absolutely. You know? I think that's a wonderful philosophy that can carry over to so many walks of life until, of course, you get arrested. I mean, not for that, but if you want something bad enough, you should move outside your comfort zone. Be prepared to go outside your comfort zone, whatever it was you just said. That was great. I mean, you know, I think I actually don't think it's a workable life philosophy. I'm kind of kidding. But I also understand the point that he's making. All right. So 888-720-WNPR. That's 888-720-9677. That's the number to call. There's no guest here. Just you, me, whatever you decide. Oh, Jonathan McPants, who's producing this episode and screening calls, wants me to point out that we decided yesterday. So this show has been on the air since September 1st, 2009, something like that. And we decided at the rebranding meeting yesterday that we never had been branded. We had no brand. And so this was we're not actually involved in a rebranding. We're involved in a branding. This whole it kind of just sounds like some kind of cattleman Western every time I say things like that. But anyway, take that for what it's worth. All right, I have to move on. 888-720-WNPR. Let me go to Brett in Newington. Hi, Brett. You're on the air.
Hey, happy 12 years and 12 weeks anniversary.
Good math.
Roughly. Octopus Teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Documentary or interaction that was recorded.
Yeah.
And it brings up some useful information on just how much time and dedication it takes to establish a good, strong relationship with someone who doesn't trust you.
Whether that's an octopus or
guys,
a person.
We can learn from that.
Yeah.
So, but speaking about guys learning from something, I was listening to the Supremes this morning. No, not the band, the Justices. And they were talking about things. Well, a majority of them were talking about things that they should have a much less amount of input. I don't know how many of the justices are female, but I think they should have a predominant weight to their opinion versus, you know, like, because guys, we have like, what, at most 20 hours of input in this, and they have at least 6 months before viability. So, you know, do the math on there. The female justice should probably get about 100-to-1 vote over the males.
So you're saying to the male justices, stop in the name of love. I'm just sort of working on, you know, carrying your own joke forward.
Here you go.
I would like to point out that
the good connection. That's a great callback.
100% of the Supremes were female. I'd also like to point that out. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I don't think it really works that way. I mean, let me just say a couple of things about the Supreme Court this morning. First of all, you can't judge anything by, first of all, you can't hurry love. I want to make that point emphatically. But you can't judge anything by interrogatories. Routinely, justices ask questions that don't represent their actual thinking. In fact, that often will represent a line of inquiry that they hope they can discredit, but they want to know more about it. They want to know what the argument is. So, I mean, looking at Kavanaugh, who's probably the most interesting person in this whole theater there, you know, you don't necessarily know what he's going to do. I mean, apparently, and I didn't listen to every word of this, it seemed as though he might be willing to uphold the Mississippi law. But you don't really know from interrogatories. It's a huge mistake. And the other thing is that, you know, I mean, nominally anyway, and so much of what gets explored in an interrogatory like this one is, on what basis can you overturn a 50-year-old existing precedent? You know, there's a thing called stare decisis, this idea that these things stand unless there's some real compelling cause to change them. Now, the compelling cause could be, as Roberts, I think, dangled today, viability, changing thoughts about viability, changing understanding, changing knowledge about viability. I think it's risky to listen to an interrogatory and then think you know what's going to happen. All right, here's Terry from Stanford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Am I on the line?
You are on the line. You are on the air.
Thank you so much.
Thousands and thousands of people are listening to you. Okay, yeah, sure.
Thank you for taking my call. Following up on your comments about Trump and the GOP, I'm looking ahead to the 2022 and 24 elections, and I am looking for references, that is, websites, books, et cetera, which chronicle Trump's many illegal or borderline illegal anti-democratic activities, because I think we have to be prepared for a lot of competing narratives between facts and alternate facts and that sort of thing. And I really think we need to speak from, a knowledgeable base of information. And I remember you have interviewed over the years many people who really knew a great deal about this. Do you know of any particular websites that you would recommend or books?
It might be a little bit early for the books. There's a whole spate of books coming out right now, including the one by Woodward and Costa, for example, about sort of the kind of election meltdown, the attempt to discredit the results, and then the ultimate riot that ensued from it. But I think, I mean, every day brings something new. Right now, it looks like Mark Meadows, his last chief of staff, has a book coming out, some of which has been leaked to, I think, The Guardian, in which, among other things, Meadows, his chief of staff, reveals that prior to his debate, his October 2nd debate with Joe Biden, he'd already tested positive for COVID. He'd had a positive test and a negative test. He didn't disclose either one of them. Now the Washington Post is trying to set up a timeline to figure all this stuff out. But basically, you know, he, having tested, I mean, and to be clear, he did get really sick right after that debate. That's when almost immediately after that debate, he started to get sick. And at the time, there were questions like, is it possible that he walked into a debate with Joe Biden, who's even older than Trump is, with a COVID infection? So, every day brings some new disclosure. The other thing is, right now, I mean, the work of the Senate committee is not done, and it does appear that increasingly they'll do as they did with Steve Bannon. They are going to be citing people for contempt. Trump is doing everything in his power to keep some of the people who know a lot about how the riot came about from testifying or sharing the information they have. So, you know, I mean, that whole thing has to play out, too. I think, you know, there's no way to write a definitive book about this right now because not all the information is on the table. Once that inquiry plays itself out, I think you'll know a lot more.
Well, I was wondering, do you know of any websites that particularly chronicled day by day what he was doing? Because it's very hard to go back and recall all of the many travesties that were visited upon the country. Do you know of any chronicling websites?
Like just a sort of a day by day timeline thing? No, I'm not even sure that that would be the most effective way to try to understand this. Although if you've got the time, most people don't have the time to review, you know, every day of a 4-year presidency. One thing that I would suggest, it's not a perfect solution, but and it doesn't cover the attempt to discredit the election results. It doesn't cover the riot and stuff. But we really liked Carlos Lozada's book, which I think is called What Were We Thinking? What Were They Thinking? Something like that. Lozada, who's the Pulitzer Prize winning book critic for The Washington Post, read as many Trump books as any human being possibly could. I can't remember how many of them, but he attempted to read every Trump book that was available. His book is called What Were We Thinking? So, and that's a nice sort of summary of what was out there at a given moment. But Carlos's book itself came out, you know, a few years ago. So, I mean, it's not going to have everything. Or, I don't know, 18 months ago. I don't know when it came out. I'm guessing. All right. We're going to take one more call, and then we're going to take a break, and we're going to reset, and we're going to come back in our last call of this segment. By the way, the number, if you want to call in, and we now have a lot of open lines available. So if you were frustrated or thwarted earlier, you can now call 888-720-WNPR. That's 888-720-9677, and you will decide what we are going to talk about. Here's Joe in New Haven. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Colin. How you doing?
Okay.
Okay. So I'm suffering from an earworm that you planted in my brain 6 years ago.
Uh-oh.
Sorry it's taken me this long to call, but I've suffered more with it than you have.
Okay.
So at one point, before COVID and before Trump, at the end of Obama's presidency, I believe it was Merrick Garland that he appointed to the Supreme Court, nominated.
Nominated, yeah.
But they didn't pick it up.
Right.
The Supreme Court didn't pick it up.
Well, Mitch McConnell refused to allow the nomination to be heard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here's what you said to that, and it really kind of caught my imagination. You said, I believe, something to the effect that because they didn't even discuss it, they had turned their backs on their responsibility, and Obama should just nominate him.
Yeah, or just appoint him. Yeah.
But I never heard any follow-up from you. I've never heard it in the media writ large, read anything about it. Do you have any further explanation as to why it wasn't tried?
No, I don't. I'd have to go back and do a little bit more reading to kind of refresh my memory of the whole scenario and what the rules and possibilities are. There are, you know, obviously interim appointments. I don't know that you can do an interim appointment of a Supreme Court justice, but it did seem at the time. I mean, I actually chart the breakdown, the sort of newly significant paradigm-changing breakdown of American democracy right at that moment. When McConnell refused to call that nomination, he was essentially violating a whole set of procedures that had existed for a really long time that relied on everybody kind of playing by the same rules, everybody cooperating in more or less the same way, relied on the understanding that presidents have the right to nominate Supreme Court justices and have those nominations heard in the normal formal setting, and that barring some kind of gigantic galactic defect, they should get their appointees confirmed. And that all went out the window. And I think since then, I mean, that's all pre-Trump, but I think that was the beginning of the end that we're living through right now. So, and maybe we need a different system too. I don't know. I sort of feel like the way that we get Supreme Court justices, it's a little bit like what Churchill said about democracy. It's a really bad system, except for it's better than all the other ones. I'm sure Churchill said it better than that. it's a terrible system until you consider all the alternatives. All right, we'll go. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to Bill. We'll talk to George. Ideally, we'll talk to people who are women and have women's names. Of course, George could be like George Sand or something, so you never know. We are back. Special thanks to Kat Pastor. She's our technical producer. She is getting things done here, as she usually does. Jonathan McPants is in the call screening room calling screening calls and calling screens, too. He's called up a number of screens. What else do I have to say? That's about it. Well, I can actually mention, if you're listening here on Wednesday, and obviously podcast listeners, who knows when you're listening or what you're doing. But I should tell you, tomorrow's show is about the supply chain. It's Lily Tyson's supply chain show. I think this is going to be really interesting. And I'm coming into this, you know, less knowledgeable even than I am about many things. On Friday, The Nose, we're going to talk about The Beatles Get Back, the Peter Jackson 7.5 hour, 3-part recording session documentary. And we're not sure about Monday, maybe an Omicron show. We're not sure. And then on Tuesday, I still don't believe this is happening, but on Tuesday, it seems as though I will be interviewing Joe Lieberman, which has not happened since 2006. 06, is that when that was? And the last time we tried to talk together on the air, it went so badly it made national news. So I'm very impressed and somewhat apprehensive about the idea that he's got a book out. People who have a book out, they'll talk to Satan. Now, I think Joe Lieberman and I have differing opinions about which one of us is Satan. But anyway, that is the plan for Tuesday. All right. So now you know. And we have some calls here. The number 888-720-WNPR. You're allowed to bring up anything. It doesn't have to be about politics or news. Or you can bring about up anything that's in your soul. 888-720-9677. Let's go to George in West Haven. Hi, George.
Colin, good afternoon. I don't know if you know about Heather Cox Richardson. She wrote a fascinating book called How the South Won the Civil War. And I think if there's any book that anybody wants to read and needs to read about what's going on politically right now, that's the book. She's absolutely fascinating. She has
a newsletter. She has a newsletter. I'll cut you short a little bit and say she has been on the show as a guest. But the show that she was on was about newsletters. And her newsletter, which I believe is called Letters from an American, I'm going to say, is, first of all, it's just an incredible phenomenon even within the world of newsletters. It, you know, was one of the really, as newsletters became an increasing publishing / journalism phenomenon, she was, you know, really the first big breakout star. You know, there a lot of it was people who were already famous in other ways, like Andrew Sullivan or Matt Taibbi moving over into the, leaving what they were doing and moving into the newsletter format. But nobody, I mean, except for you, you've read her book, but like people hadn't really heard of her. And then suddenly she, I don't know how many million subscribers she has, but she's got a lot and it tends to be, continues to be vital. And she's one of those people who, you know, I mean, a couple of days a week or one day a week, she'll just sort of be exhausted and just put up a picture of Maritime Maine or something. But the rest of the time, she's pumping these things out, you know, every day, long essays at 2 o'clock in the morning or something. And she's terrific. So, yeah. No, we know all about Heather Cox Richardson. Maybe we'll re-air that newsletter show at some point because it was a good show and it's still relevant. If you're looking for other newsletters, I mean, that's the thing, though. My newsletter tastes change all the time. I think if I were going to do that show again, I would have a slightly different group of guests, although I would still have Heather Cox Richardson, of course. But one person I think we had on that show is the guy who does The Tangle. And I really recommend, if you're trying to sort of understand, I mean, to me, the test of so much journalism, particularly political journalism, is can I get a grasp of what's going on? How good a grasp of what's going on do I get if I access this particular television news show or television commentary show or a radio show or newspaper or magazine or newsletter. And I do think there's a newsletter called The Tangle, and I think the guy who puts it out is named Isaac Saul, but don't hold me to that, although I think he was also on our show. And that's a really good one. Like, what are the things he does with every issue he covers? And it's a daily newsletter, I think probably just weekday newsletter. But he sort of says, here's what the right says. Here's what the left says. Here's what I think. And it's very reasoned. And he just gives you a very, very good picture of how the debate's unfolding without cheating you out of one side or the other. So I don't know. Newsletters are great, though. I tend to subscribe to more of them than I can possibly read, but they are great. All right. Here's Bill from Hartford. You're on the air.
Am I actually talking to the great Colin McEnroe?
No, just some idiot who has a radio show.
Good. This is a first for me. I've never, ever, ever, ever been able to get through. But anyways, you know, that's why you said no one was calling, so I called you. I'm driving, which I shouldn't be doing, and talking at the same time, but I can handle both. Mm. And you never wanted to interview me when my book came out, but that's another story. Look, this is what I'd like. And then when I got caught connected, I said, well, what am I going to ask you? Because I didn't have anything in mind. But I just looked at my phone right before driving, and I saw that the Epstein Jezzeline's facilitator is in trial. And a 14-year-old at the time claims that she was brought to Donald Trump. And that's all I saw. So have you heard or read any more about this? This is breaking as I'm talking to you, but I just haven't had a chance to thoroughly read.
I know that the trial's happening, and I was trying to keep an eye on it and 16 other things that were happening as we got ready. I will recommend it. There's a pretty interesting piece, again, in the Washington Post about her and Elizabeth Holmes, both of whom are on trial for very, very different things. I think the title of the piece is Women Can Be Evil Too, or something like that. But, you know, I mean, I think this is one of a number of criminal actions, criminal prosecutions, criminal trials that are a source of great concern to Donald Trump and the people who follow him. Some of those criminal actions specifically involve him or target his commercial organization. But then there are trials like this one where, yeah, there could be sort of some residual problems if testimony like that were to come out and were to hold up and were impossible to discredit. There's a lot of X factors there. So, yeah, I mean, you know, stay tuned to that. But I don't want to comment. I mean, first of all, let me just say one thing, because I do have a minute or so here. One of the things that we do a lot in especially on shows like Colin shows or things like that, but just in general as people, there's maybe more of a rush to judgment than there ever has been before. I mean, we've always been kind of inclined towards that. That's why we have an idiom like rush to judgment. But when a trial's unfolding, the information that comes out of the trial, first of all, to extract it from its context can be misleading. And, you know, when the Rittenhouse verdict landed, obviously, just in terms of my value set, I was not happy to hear that. But I was not one of the people, even informally or privately, saying, well, it's a racist jury or something like that. The truth is, when a trial comes to an end, if you haven't sat there and covered the trial, you have no idea whether it's a good verdict or not. I mean, it's almost impossible to know that, because a trial is an attempt to apply a set of rules, parentheses, laws, close parentheses, on a set of facts. It isn't a value proposition. And as a result, I mean, to sort of, you know, read some coverage of it and try to get somewhat familiar with the facts of the case and what got said at trial, and then see the verdict and render an opinion about that. You usually don't have as much information as you would need. You know, you really would have to see the entire trial and see. I mean, sometimes, you know, I to this day couldn't tell you. Maybe the prosecution didn't do as good a job as it could have done against Rittenhouse. Maybe they also, and it's also all predicated on, in this case, the laws of a state too. I mean, Wisconsin's laws are not something that we necessarily have a basic familiarity with. and their understanding, their legal understanding encoded in statute of self-defense is kind of maybe different from ours and stuff. So I don't know. I'm almost very, very reluctant to look at a trial. I mean, I think the OJ trial might be the big exception because everybody was watching that all the time. But for the most part, eh. So I'm just saying at the end, we got a tweet from somebody recommending a newsletter called WTF just happened today as a somewhat comprehensive resource for Trump misdeeds. So that perhaps might satisfy the woman who wanted to know more about that. All right. So thank you for listening today. I dare not take another caller. The show is almost over. Thanks to you for listening every day and any day. Tell your friends. We are available on any podcast platform. If you know somebody who lives someplace other than around here who might enjoy the show, we love that. And so all podcast platforms carry the Colin McEnroe Show. So tell your friends who live in other places. We would love to introduce them to some of the work that we do. And thanks once again to Cat Pastor, to Jonathan McPants, and to everybody out there listening. We'll be back with another show on another day.
Connected.